All right. Well, my name is Joe Grand.
I'm Zaz Brooks.
And we're going to talk about Prototype This, which was a TV show we did on Discovery Channel. And we're going to get into some details of some projects, because details, I think, are what people are here for. And we'll probably just talk some shit about the whole TV process as we go.
Yeah, I'm sure some people have seen the show, but if you haven't...
There's like five of them out there.
Yeah. If you haven't, you'll still enjoy the talk, because you'll see some really cool projects. But basically, it was a show about engineering on Discovery Channel and about the whole process of coming up with ideas and reducing them to a real prototype that mostly worked.
Yeah, usually. So what we tried to do is kind of follow the true design process of, you know, coming up with the idea, building it, testing it, refining it. And I put true in quotes because nothing in TV is really real or true. If there's a camera there, it's probably been done a million times.
Definitely don't believe everything you see on TV. And actually, after you make TV, you can never really watch it again, because you're like, oh, yeah, they rehearsed this scene like 10 times, the natural like meet and greet scene or whatever, so they could get all the different angles. Like, even the most basic thing, there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. But with our projects, we really built them, and when you see them work or not work, that was real engineering.
Yeah, we're bitter old men. So let's see. The show aired in the U.S. in October 2008. We made 13 episodes over 18 months. And, sometimes the project worked, sometimes they didn't. February 2009, apparently, they aired throughout the world. And, like, they're still airing. I heard a rumor that they're also available on BitTorrent. I don't know. Someone told me that.
Yeah, and when we say throughout the world, we really mean it. I got an email from a friend of mine who was working for the IAEA in Kazakhstan. He was like, dude, it's got the Kazakhstan and turn on the TV, and you were there, dubbed into Kazakh.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, so there's four guys building prototypes of stuff. That's me. I'm the electrical engineer and resident hardware hacker, and I guess the resident daddy, new daddy at that.
Yeah, they like everyone to have their role on the show, so mine was the robotics and coding guy.
And, mad scientist. He's good as a robot, too.
Yeah, I do a lot of other stuff, too. I like to build hardware, and I like to do pyro and stuff like that. So the best I could do in getting some of that stuff on this show was the mad scientist aspect.
And it was actually really one of the really good things about the show is that the casting process actually worked. You know, they got four guys that have complete different skills. So there's no real butting heads, and nobody's like, you know, my dick is bigger than yours, at least at first. But, you know, so Zaz and I were more on the technology side, hardware, software, and, yeah, we do more, but that's sort of what we were pigeonholed into. Mike North is our mechanical engineer, material scientist, pretty boy, and he's going to kill me if he hears that, but he's definitely the best looking of the four. And then we had Terry Sandin, who is a special effects guy from L.A., also our machinist and fabricator. So we all had our different skills, and it worked out pretty well. But what you don't see a lot of on the program is everybody that actually helped us behind the scenes. Because, yes, there's four of us on screen, but there's dozens, sometimes like up to 30 in an episode that are helping us build stuff behind the scenes while we're being filmed walking in the door five times.
Yeah, it's like any good project. It takes a lot of people and a lot of contributors. And there's a lot of the things on the show there's no way we could have done without the help that we brought in. And it's just a shame for us that these guys didn't get the credit they deserved on the show. But we want to mention them here because they put in tons of time and effort, did great job.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, we must give credit where credit is due. So on the show, we built a lot of crazy stuff, and we're going to just show like some brief pictures of stuff, and then we'll show details of the projects that were our favorite. Here we had like some 10-foot giant boxing robots that would fight each other based on the movement of players outside the ring with optical glyph tracking and wireless accelerometers and some cool hydraulics. Actually, you know, I just realized if we get through enough of these slides, we could even show some like crazy videos that we're not allowed to, that we weren't allowed to show like while we were filming the show. So I might be able to dig up some of those.
So here's a few other projects. We had an electric legged vehicle. So, you know, there's all these different layers of stuff that had to go into it that maybe or, you know, maybe not made it on screen. So up there in the top left, you know, with an electric vehicle, we had these new lithium iron phosphate batteries. There was no BMS for them, so Joe had to design and build from scratch a battery management system for these batteries because you couldn't get one off the shelf. And just little things like that consume an amazing amount of time and engineering skill, and to the average viewer, just goes straight over their head. Because of the way that it's cut. I'm sure people would love to hear about this stuff, but it wasn't on the show.
Right. Let's see, what else? We had a get up and go. There's Zaz getting automatically woken up and his clothes ripped off and showered. That was hot. That was an awesome episode. we had a automatic pizza delivery system. This guy in the middle, Luigi, on top of a Segway base, which we did not build, but it's actually company Marathon Robotics that Zaz's brother works at.
Yeah, well, we pitched this automated pizza delivery idea to the network, and they say, oh, you know, it's great. You guys got to do it. And I was like, well, you know, how are we going to get this done in a couple of weeks? Because we didn't have much more time than that. And just at that moment, my brother, who's founded a robotics company in Australia, had their product ready to go. And I said, hey, you know, if we flew you over here, do you reckon your robot could navigate through the streets of San Francisco? And he's like, well, if there's anyone in the world that can do it, it's us. We have this experience to it. And they flew out, disassembled their military droid, right? This thing weighs like 300 pounds because it's armored. It's actually a target for snipers. They disassembled it and carried it on the plane in their checked luggage. Put it together, and we delivered pizza with it.
Yeah, so we had to build that box on top. I don't know what else. We'll skip some stuff. Oh, yeah. So contrary to popular belief, we hardly got paid, and we hardly had any money to actually build stuff with. So it's not like, oh, you're on TV, you're rich. Here's $1 million to go build stuff. We had around...
Yeah, prototype budget, yeah, which included all materials, any kind of fabrication we had to do off-site, shipping, everything like that, was $12,000 per prototype.
And, yeah, some of you guys are probably like, oh, it's so much money, dude. I could do so much stuff with that. But you really can't, especially when you have to buy the steel, and steel's expensive, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, we didn't have a lot of time either. We had between 2 to 3 weeks per episode. And what was interesting about that is that the networks, the TV producers were like, well, you know, we need you to build stuff that's never been done before that looks awesome on TV. And, it has to work, and it has to be done in 2 weeks. So there's like all this stuff, and we're like, and then they're like, oh, can you build the electric force field in 2 weeks? And we're like, I don't know, can we?
Yeah, not only do they not know anything about the engineering details, they really don't care. And that was brought home to us right from the start when we shot the pilot, and they were doing the schedule of shooting. And they were like, okay, well, all you guys are going to be together on Wednesday, so that's where we'll shoot the demo of the prototype. And then on Thursday, it's just you and Joe, so that's where you guys will develop the electronics. We're like, wait a second, we have to actually develop the electronics before we demo the final prototype. It won't work in the other order.
Yeah. And actually, didn't that producer leave or skip out on America's Next Top Model to come work for our show?
Yeah, she really should have chosen America's Next Top Model. It was more suited.
Yeah. It's an interesting, being a technical person going into the TV business, how many of you guys work in TV? There's like one. Oh, Captain Crunch. Yeah, but you're sort of technical, so... Nobody. Okay, that makes sense, right? Because if you're technical, you probably don't work in TV. anyway, there was a bunch of challenges with the show. We're not going to completely rip on them. But the hardest part for us as engineers was try to share the engineering process in a way that was fun and not boring. And, like, how do you show coding? And how do you watch a guy, like, you know, type on the computer or a guy soldering? That's very hard to do. So we tried to come up with kind of fun stuff to do that.
And the reason I did the show and the reason I signed on to it in the first place was because I wanted to make something that the next generation, the kids out there, would watch and be like, man, being an engineer or a scientist fucking rocks. Yeah. It's so much fun.
Yeah.
Look at the cool shit you get to do.
And we've actually received a lot of emails, which is interesting. It's funny because Discovery Channel, their target audience was, what, 30 to 49 or something like that?
Yeah, so and this show had been sold as being like the greatest stuff you would never see in the Sharper Image catalog. So they sold other ads based on people who shop at Sharper Image,
right?
25 to 50-year-old males. You know, when you're 25 to 50-year-old, you pretty much are an engineer already if you want to be. But the feedback we've been getting from people that really, really dug the show were exactly high schoolers and pre-high schoolers that watched it and were like, yeah, I want to make robots now.
Yeah, and guys starting college that are like, you make engineering fun, what do we do? So the byproduct of all of this was, you know, the inspiring people ended up being, like, the way coolest part of this whole thing. And, like, meeting Zaz, I guess. So let's see, the first project, the traffic busting truck. This was the third thing we built or something, right? It was pretty early on.
Yeah, in terms of things that we'd built, it was the fourth, but it was the second 2AS show that we did.
Right. And this one was, it was essentially we were trying to build this car or truck that could elevate itself and drive over traffic, park sideways, move sideways, and like automatically park into parking spots, parallel park, completely autonomous, computer controlled.
It's sort of like a real life transformer. You know, it goes from being a regular car that can drive on the roads to something that can get up on stilts and go over other cars.
Right. So this had, let's see, this we actually took about 4 weeks to do. And here's some, So here's the final truck parked over another car. So you drive it regularly, and then the things would unfold and lift up the truck. And there's actually a shot in the show of Kevin driving the truck to where we were where we were setting this up. And a cop pulled up, and he's like, "Hello, officer," and, you know, drove away. Because I don't think this thing was street legal. And actually, I have a picture that I didn't show here of a meter maid standing in front of these two cars, sort of like, you know, it's like, who do you give the parking ticket to? And, yeah, so he looked at it, he's like, "Well, you know, the first car is close enough to the curb, but it looks like those wheels are pretty far out, so I could probably give you a ticket for that." But he didn't. He was nice.
So there was a lot of learning for us along the way, even though they tried to make us do stuff we already knew how to do, but this was the first time that we'd worked with controlling hydraulics, with these omnidirectional Mecanum wheels that weighed something like 200 or 300 pounds a piece. So, you know, we really had to learn on the fly what was going on.
And so the way we had the control mechanism set up, so Kevin Binkert, one of our guest builders, who was actually a host of the show at the time, built up the mechanical portion of the legs that would tilt up hydraulically and lift up. And then Zaz and I worked on all of the control systems to control it. And we used something called Airtrax wheels, which are the omnidirectional wheels. And we had a control interface to drive the wheels, and they took 0 to 5 volts as an analog signal, and then it would move the wheels forward or backwards, and we'd have another signal for left and right. So we had that interface, and we had to come up with a way to do all of the other circuitry around it.
I got to tell this story because the each individual wheel had its own processor built in into its server control system. They all communicated over CAN, and they had a plug-in joystick module that just did a 0 to 5 volt control. And so Joe did a wireless controller based on the PlayStation 2 interface and got it working in like a day to control this thing wirelessly. And the Airtrax guys were just like, "Whoa, we've been trying to do this for like a year and haven't got it working. And you just did it in a day."
Thanks. So once we got that working, the first thing we did was put the Airtrax wheels on a test couch, and we like drove the couch around, and we'll try to show you a video of that. So the way that I did at least the wireless PS2 control was with the basic stamp 2P40, and we had an RF key fob and then the PS2 interface, and I had the basic stamp dealing with the wireless input of the PS2, figuring out which buttons were which, and then using digital pots to set the 0 to 5 volt levels to control the Airtrax. Then we had some MOSFETs for the solenoid and hydraulic stuff. But then we had a serial port that would connect to Zaz's computer that would do all of the higher level control aspects and then send data to me, and then my board would actually drive the Airtrax. So it was a kind of cool process.
So, you know, one of the things that was really important for the network, for some reason, was to have the car be autonomous and be able to park itself. And, you know, that's kind of sexy, but they, you know, weren't too interested in showing the details. And, you know, we had to think hard about how we were going to get this done in just a few days, like a car park itself, because that can be a challenge.
And we could also easily fake it if they don't show the details, right? So we could have just remote controlled the whole thing, which we didn't.
So we thought about what sensors we would need, and what we ended up using were two linear range sensors, an ultrasonic and an infrared, which we didn't really need the two different kinds, but we just wanted to show the sort of things that were out there, and then a stereo camera, which I'd worked with a lot beforehand, and we got this really nice one from Vudiri Design. They loaned us two of them, actually. It's two cameras and a custom FPGA on board that does the stereo correlation and supplies depth in real time as a 32-bit image. So you get RGB and depth in the same image. But then I had to write all the code to actually use that for something. So what I decided to do was just make use of the fact that the autonomous wheels let us drive this thing directly in any direction. So we'd pull up the couch to a row of cars and assume that you're pretty much parallel. You're going to get out of the car and then press the button and it'll park itself. So the stereo was used to align the direction of travel of the vehicle so it could move up and down the cars, and it would just cruise forward using the infrared sensor to look for a gap between the cars and look for the start of the gap, the end of the gap, using dead reckoning on the wheels, and decide if it's big enough to park. And if it was, it would back itself up in the middle and then slide in and use the ultrasonic to detect the curb and know when to stop. So it was a pretty simple controller, and you know, it means you have to set things up and sort of pre-park the car a little bit, but it meant that we could get this done in a couple of days.
We crashed a few times. Yeah, hopefully we'll be able to show you a video of that too.
It helps to have a couch that you don't care what you crash it into.
Yeah, or cars. So this is another one, the Firefighter Power Pack. This is one of my favorite episodes because we actually got to work with real firefighters, and real firefighters are totally awesome and like super manly. Even if they're women, these guys are awesome.
And you can tell how senior they are and how badass by the size of their mustache,
including
really
the women
mustaches.
Yeah. So we had a lot of fun because we actually went to the firefighters and said, you know, what sort of things do you need? And we had our ideas. We said, you know, would a high-tech pack be cool? And that would let you be able to see in the dark and give you, you know, use a thermal imaging camera and identify other firefighters and all of this stuff. And they're like, yeah, that would be really cool. And we're like, okay, we'll go do it, and we'll come back in a few weeks and have you judge us, basically.
Yeah, we got to say, we were kind of shitting ourselves, right, because firefighting, that's a serious business, and these guys aren't going to get on TV and say, oh, you know, yeah, that thing's good when it really sucks. Yeah. So we, you know, made sure to meet with them ahead of time and see what they really wanted and that they were cool with the ideas, because the last thing we wanted is to just pull some ideas out of our ass and show it to them and then be like, you know, you college types, you just don't know shit. Like, get out of our face.
Where's your mustache? I felt very inferior when I was with those guys. So, you know, it was cool. So we went, actually, one of the first things we did is went to the Modesto Firefighting Training Center in California and actually went through the process of what they go through, like climbing the ladders and putting out fires and wearing the masks and all this, like, super cool firefighter stuff, just so they could show us how hard it actually was. And it was pretty fucking hard.
It's a hard job. But at the same time, you can see why they all love it. Like, these guys, they train constantly. They're always out at the facility every week doing this stuff. And it's a ton of fun using the hose. And they do all kinds of real fire training. And these guys are all just like, yeah, we totally love what we do. We wouldn't swap jobs with anyone.
I love using hose. Okay. So that was really bad.
you'll never work in TV again.
No. All right, so the Pyro Pack, we'll show you details of it, but the first thing to pay attention to is that it was this molded pack that was especially designed to fit on my body. And the theory was, you know, in the future, every firefighter would have a pack that's custom to them because the packs are really bulky right now and sort of unwieldy. So this was a custom molded one. The first thing we had to do is get some 3D body scans. So here's like some hot nerds getting body scans. You have to wear these white suits, which were very revealing.
Yeah, we don't have the photo of it, but somehow, I don't know how it happened, when Joe first came out with his bodysuit on, someone had accidentally left a huge banana in the pair of pants. I've never seen a banana that big before.
Actually, oh no, the banana's out by then, but it looks pretty huge. I'm just kidding, the banana's still in there. and actually it was funny because we did this shot, like, I don't know if you've seen the show, and you know they're playing cheesy music and we all come out in our white outfits, and I had the banana down my pants for like the first five takes until our producer was like, Joe, oh god, come on. And she's like, god, and I'm like, how come you didn't notice earlier? She's like, I wasn't looking down there, I was trying not to look. So I don't know which one actually made the final edit. So we were 3D scanned in this facility that exists for mostly scanning like movie celebrities and actors and porn stars and stuff to get their body shape, and especially for, you know, Hollywood actors, because their time is so expensive apparently, they get scanned and then the wardrobe people can work on their exact body scan while the guy goes off and, you know, sits in the Bahamas or does drugs or something. It was a really cool place. We got our body scanned into like a what is it, cloud point format or something.
It gets scanned into just a point cloud, and then they have to. It's a huge file, and they have to run an interpolation on there to skin it, And even the file you get out of that still has a lot of defects and has to be cleaned up by hand. So it's still a pretty human-intensive process to get it done.
Well, you can tell, like, all of my muscles disappeared, so there must be some loss in, like, that data. So I don't know. So the pack was 3D printed by a place in San Diego, so we had the actual pack. But I think the cooler stuff is the electronics and what goes on inside. So obviously we had the breathing air tank, it's not oxygen, it's air. We had a primary regulator, a digital pressure transmitter. So what we're trying to do is make a high-tech pack. So you have, on a regular pack, you already have your breathing air. You have the regulator, but you have this analog remaining air gauge thing, which is just really annoying for firefighters, and it dangles off.
It's exactly like what you have on a scuba rig.
Yeah.
You know, it's a high-pressure connection to a dial, and you have to pick this thing up and look at it, even if you're in a smoky environment and you can't really see anything.
Yeah, so a lot of the stuff they use is very hard to use. We have a dry cam, which we'll talk about in a second, drill battery and circuit board, and then in the headset, we have a thermal imaging camera and a heads-up micro display, so the firefighter can actually look through or look up to the heads-up display and see images in the dark. We don't have a picture except for the compressed air, or sorry, the dry cam. You want to explain that?
So we talked to a guy that had done a lot of. It was an innovator himself. He was a firefighter, a captain of the fire department, and he'd come up with a lot of inventions himself for a new piece of kit. And he told us that a lot of fires that they go to are just a small kitchen fire or something, and if they could run in and put it out quickly with a small extinguisher, it saves it getting into a bigger fire and having to get the hose in and everything. Because a lot of damage that gets done to a house when there's a fire is actually the damage that's caused by all the water and everything. So we thought, well, why don't we build a small extinguisher into this pack, kind of a superhero rig that they can run in and just point and shoot, and there'd be a lot of small fires that they could just deal with without having to roll out all the equipment.
Yeah, so it made you look like a freaking, I guess we can say fucking, makes you look like a fucking superhero. So it was cool. Yeah, two people are like, yay, superheroes. I love those guys. Okay, so the electronics for that, I used another basic stamp. One of the things with the projects is, even though we had 2 weeks to build the whole thing, we had like a day to really develop the design and the electronics. So I like using basic stamps because I had a lot of code pre-written, but they were just very easy to use, and Parallax sent us a ton of shit for free to use on the show, so it was a very easy decision. But you can do a lot with them. So I used basic stamp, the RFID reader module that I happened to design, and an accelerometer to do motion sensing. So some of the packs, the firefighter packs, if you wear them, there's some sort of sensor that detects if the firefighter isn't moving. So we wanted to do that electronically, which then you could attach, which we didn't, but you could attach to like an RF transmitter. So if a firefighter goes down, then you transmit outside to the firefighters outside, and they know that somebody's down and they can run in and save them. And then we use a Bob 4-H on-screen display to do the on-screen text. And then imagine... OLED micro display, which is the heads-up display that we use. So it was a kind of cool design that worked. We had so the screen, this is what the firefighter sees in the bottom image, the thermal image, because one of the problems they say is that when they go into a smoky room, a lot of their missions or activities are in these dark smoky rooms, and they don't know who's in there or what. So they walk in, and you know they sort of have to feel around. And maybe they'll encounter a person on the floor, maybe they'll encounter a person standing up. But if they go up to the person standing up and it's a firefighter, they don't know who the firefighter is. And what they told us is that they normally like take off their air mask and go, "Who the fuck are you?" And then, you know, the guy's like, "I'm Zaz." So it's very inefficient. And especially when it's loud, if there's a fire going, it's really noisy, it's smoky, there's noise outside.
Identification is really key to them because they need to know if it's a guy from their unit or not, because they're trying to coordinate in this environment. And you know, if it's not just some random firefighter and he's doing his job, well, that's not important. But if it's one of your guys, you need to know which rooms he's cleared and what he's up to and that kind of thing. And it's, you know, everything is super low tech. It really is just yelling at each other.
Yeah. So what we decided to do is like, okay, maybe we can have some sort of firefighter identification system that's just really, really simple. So that's what we use the RFID for, is that we outfitted everybody with RFID tags on their equipment before they went in, you know, before we went in for our final test, and set up basically had a table lookup inside the code to say Zaz corresponds to these RFID unique ID numbers. Joe corresponds to these. So then when we went in to do the test, I could walk around in the room with my heads-up display. I'd see the image of somebody, like the outline, but I wouldn't know who they were. So I could walk up and use my RFID tag, which was mounted to the wristband with the extinguisher, and I could just, you know, touch somewhere on Zaz or come close to Zaz with the reader and identify him, and his name would pop up on the screen.
And this thermal camera was really, I mean, it really kicked ass, because the first test that we did of the system, we had a room that was completely filled with smoke. You couldn't see anything at all with the naked eye, and I was hiding from Joe, and I locked myself in the cupboard. And Joe could see me in the thermal camera through the smoke and through the cupboard and just walked straight.
Just walked
me.
Right, yeah. I didn't even know there was smoke in the room. So that was sort of fun. And that, you know, that was one of the few episodes that actually had a real human purpose to it. So, you know, we weren't in the business of commercializing stuff, but maybe somebody someday will. And we own all of the intellectual property that we designed on the show, not Discovery Channel. So, you know, maybe one day we'll decide to do something with it. But that one was fun because it actually helped people.
How long do we have?
No.
Okay. We don't really know how much time we have since we started late, so we're just going to keep talking and talking and talking until someone kicks us off. The virtual sea adventure, which we called the Sea Cave, was essentially this underwater virtual environment where, say you want to go swim with sharks in the Bahamas, but you don't really want to go swim with sharks in the Bahamas. You want to stay in California where it's in your swimming pool where it's relatively safe.
Yeah, but you still want the experience of doing scuba. You still want to be underwater and breathing out of a tank and all the rest of that. So this is an environment. It's totally physically immersive, but you get the 180-degree field of view image as though you were really there in whatever the remote environment is.
So we had a projection screen set up. It was sort of this dome screen, and we all got scuba certified and put on scuba gear and went underwater. So you'd see this screen that's projecting an image sent from an ROV that's located somewhere else, an ROV that in our case was in the shark tank and we were in a different tank, and it was remotely controlled. So we used magnetic thumb control modules to control the ROV somewhere else and control the camera that was on there.
It was interesting for me too, because I learned that sharks will put up with a robot for quite a long time, but not indefinitely. It makes them angry after a while, and then you have to get out of the tank really quickly.
Yeah, they start getting really pissed off. So the major part of the build here, other than getting scuba certified, which was quite a process, is we had to figure out a way to control the ROV in some way that you're going to be underwater, you're going to be possibly in salt water, which we were in a dolphin tank, which was very, very salty. So we had to figure out how can we control the thing. You don't want to use mechanical joysticks because those are going to get corroded. Mechanical stuff's going to break. And we came across these awesome magnetic position sensors that I'm not exactly really what they're used for, but we ended up using them for joystick control. So we mounted little magnets on our thumbs, on the thumbs of scuba gloves, and then the magnetic position sensors were inside of waterproof housings on this little control mechanism that we were using to control the ROV. So that was kind of fun. Those output an analog signal, so we had an A to D to just do digital conversion on that, send it to the basic stamp. The basic stamp would just send out serial packets to this Lantronics export device, which then broadcast over UDP the control data, which would be received by this export development board on the other side where the sharks were, and then converted into data, back into serial data, and then plugged into that black box on the side. So,
and we were doing this over quite a long distance. The run, yeah. The cable run was something like 1,000 feet.
A thousand feet, yeah. And we had the spec from Seabotics, the guys who made the ROV, so we knew what commands would turn on which motors to run which fans and move the thing around. And so here's the result of the real world. I grabbed this from the show. Oh my God, that's so weird. This was like one of the weirdest things I've ever experienced. It felt like you're actually swimming along with the sharks and you're controlling this RV. And yeah, it was really fun. Ooh, yeah.
So this is one of my favorite projects. It was a lot of fun. It was, I mean, an amusement park-sized ride, just a totally amazing thing to build in a few weeks. And the idea that, you know, my little computer and my code was running this thing that was strong enough to tear itself apart, you know, that's when you have to really, really trust what you're writing.
Yeah, so there was a very, very complicated mechanical engineering process, CAD design, FEA, what else? I mean, this thing was a 30-foot ridiculously huge and dangerous machine, and it was awesome to ride. But there's a lot of engineering that was sort of really shrunk down in TV time. It actually took 5 weeks for the whole project, and I think the show says it took two.
don't believe what you see on TV.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, you know, it's a great piece of engineering, and it's a great ride, but to me, it's also a great kinetic sculpture. It was a real work of art. And we discovered early on that Discovery was not really interested in art at all. But to me, we got this one under their radar, and we created a huge piece of kinetic sculpture and got it on TV without telling them what it was.
And it was actually cool because once the cameras were off, like, we had all our friends come over and ride it and everything, and we'd go naked in it and backwards and upside down. So, yeah, it totally worked. And the whole point of the simulator was to simulate these insanely crazy water slide courses, right? Because most of the time you ride a water slide, it's over in like 30 seconds, if even that. And then you have to stand in line again. So this was this insane, what was it, a 3-minute ride?
Yeah, it was, the actual ride was 3 minutes, 3,600 feet. The vertical height of the slide, if you were really going to build this thing, would be almost as high as the Golden Gate Bridge. This water slide development, I never knew, right? You ride a water slide and you're like, whatever. But it turns out they do a ton of physics simulation when they construct it to make sure that it's not going to fling you out of the slide and it's not going to, you know, do any, you know, unnecessary oscillation that's going to hit your head against the wall and stuff. So now whenever I ride one, I'm like, man, there's like so much math and stuff going in this. But they use Nastran, this company Spectacular that supplied the pieces of our slide, they use a simulation software called Nastran. Its run took a month to do the simulation for this particular slide, and it didn't converge. It, like, ran for a month and then crashed. We didn't have another month to try and run the simulation again, so instead we just had to take the video that they made of the slide and do a camera fly-through and take the 6 axes of camera movement from the fly-through and convert that to an output mapping that could be used to control the actuators of the slide directly. And there are 3 control axes of the slide: the rate of spinning it round, which was a friction drive, lifting up and down the whole donut via 2 hydraulic cylinders, and then 4 cylinders to tilt it left to right.
Yeah, I don't remember if we mentioned this, but the whole system was hydraulic-based. Heavy metal.
This was a serious project. We're dealing with not only hydraulics, which we didn't have a lot of experience with, we'd only used them before on the Traffic Buster, but a system that was more than capable of totally destroying itself if you got things wrong. And so we started to learn some things that we hadn't really thought about before, and we were really lucky that we had a guy from Delta Computer Systems who had given us the RMC-150 motion controller, who had a lot of experience with doing writing control loops for hydraulics, because it turned out that the length of our hydraulic cabling introduced a really big difference in the control algorithm for the hydraulic lift axes on either side. So you couldn't just run the same control loop on them because that extra expansion and contraction of that hydraulic line made a big difference. So he sat there and twiddled these control loops for days getting it right, and that totally saved our bacon.
Yeah, totally. And this thing, if we have time, if we end up doing it in the breakout room, we will, but this thing, when it's on, it sounds like a freight train coming through, and we built this in a huge warehouse that was next to where all of our offices were and everything. And I remember one day Zaz and what was his name?
Dennis.
Yeah, Zaz and Dennis were downstairs like tweaking the controls and everything, and I'm up in the lair actually like pre-designing another project. And I hear this thing turn on, and I'm like, what the hell is that? And like, it's shaking the building, and this is like a really huge building. It scared the hell out of me, and I ran down there, and this thing's like, you know, grinding, and there's metal, and like, it was really, really cool. Hey, you embedded videos into this thing.
Yes.
Wow, you're smart. Jeez.
So even though this was a complex system and a dangerous piece of machinery, controlling it ended up involving some kind of hacks. The RMC-150 motion controller, they have an API that goes with it called RMC Tools. But I wanted to do all the UI and the control stuff in my Java environment on the Mac, and the RMC Tools wasn't supported in Java. So I ended up having to use their UDP API to just dump values into the RMC register in real time to turn things on and off, which, you know, is definitely a little bit of a hack. But how the whole system really worked was the 3DOF data that was taken from the camera fly-through converted to axis positions, velocities, and accelerations, And Beastplan interpolated it so that it was a reasonable number of points over this three-minute ride, and downloaded that to the RMC. And the visualizer, which was under RCX in Java, that was projecting the first-person point of view inside the slide so that the person could see what they wanted to see as they were writing the slide, would play, and at the same time it would dump control information into the RMC registers. And the whole time, the first times that we were running this thing, we were at the same time running RMC tools in a VM on Windows on the same machine, tweaking those control loops and making sure that the amount of slip on the friction drive especially was taken care of. And another example of things that you have to do on a show like this at short notice, which are never going to get seen by the audience, is we wanted some way to show the person's position in the virtual slide as well as that point of view. And my Mac only had a single video output that was doing the point of view video. So at very short notice, in a couple of hours the day before that we wanted to actually demonstrate this thing, I quickly whipped up a secondary visualizer on another computer that would play the different video and sync it to the first video over UDP. So, it wasn't like a super big deal, but it was just something like, oh, shit, we need this now, and it has to be done. And
it was awesome. The end result of this thing was amazing. DEF CON 18, unfortunately. So this is the TV mindset. The show ended. We got all the footage. It sat in the warehouse for a few weeks. No one knew what to do with it. And the TV network said, destroy it. Recycle the steel. So it is gone. And that completely sucks.
Yeah, I couldn't go in there when they were cutting it up. I didn't want to see it in any pieces again. So I just, the guy sent me a photo of how it looked like standing on this big pile of scrap, which, by the way, the steel for the project alone cost something like $26,000. Yeah. The water slide material was donated by Splashtacular, which was lucky, otherwise it would have cost a lot. But shipping it across the country at short notice cost a lot. They sold that thing for $1,500 in scrap.
Ooh. Yeah, so it was a sad day in TV history. All right, so the last project we're going to show is the Flying Lifeguard, and I hope we have some more time to hang out here and answer questions and stuff. This was like the beach of the future, the 21st century life-saving device. And there's two different things we made. One was, so the majority of drownings that happen in a beach are at unguarded beaches. So we're like, okay, what if we have, a short-range cannon that essentially shoots life preservers out to a person in distress, and the person would be wearing like a GPS-based wristband that they'd purchase at the beach or whatever.
Yeah, and if you don't wear a helmet when you swim, that's your problem.
Yeah, which we learned. But what if you're not short range? Like, what if you're further out than the cannon can deliver? So we tried to build up an autonomous airplane that would receive the signal, autonomously launch, fly out to wherever the person was, miles away, at a maximum, and then deliver the payload, just drop the life jacket to them, and the life jacket hits the water and expands. So we had two different systems, and this was another one of those crazy crack-smoking TV things where, one system wasn't hard enough to build in a few weeks, so we had to do two.
And also, it's a computer-controlled plane. You can't just take off on a runway somewhere because, it's a beach, so of course you have to launch it by a rocket.
Yeah, rocket. Rubber bands won't do. So the first part is the wristband transmitter. This was a fairly simple device. It had a basic SAMP2 parallax GPS receiver module and an RF transceiver. So it would the basic SAMP would get the coordinates from the GPS once it received the button press from the person in distress, and then transmit those coordinates over the AeroCom, the AC4490, to the receiver, which would be at the base station. The cool thing about this is we used Zaz design this little enclosure for it, with a 3D printer, and it was all waterproof and sealed up nice.
To me, that was one of the coolest things about the whole show, and I just cannot freaking wait till we all have this in our house, that we could design the electronics, CAD model an enclosure, print it out, put it together, and put it in the water without ever having to go outside our own building. And
yeah, so we didn't even have to shower.
That's the whole essence to me of of the show and about rapid prototyping, is being able to just do all this in-house and just go and deploy the finished product right away.
Yeah, it was very cool. And let's see. So this is the circuitry for the part of the circuitry for the this was for the cannon. So for the cannon control circuitry, the cannon. Wait, Is it? I don't even. Oh, no, no. This goes to you. God, this is a long time ago. Okay. So this took in. This was for the Canon. And we had a bunch of math we had to do with GPS. We had an anemometer so we could measure wind speed and direction. So we knew, you know, if we had to offset the cannon or change the pressure firing the cannon because of the wind. So we were doing measurements. We used this cool, like, miniature organic LED display to show the coordinates of the cannon and then the coordinates of the person in distress. And then all of the wind speed data, and all of that was sent over an export to Zaz, again, to handle all of this stuff that really mattered. This is one of the things where it was just fun to experiment with anemometers and OLEDs and things that we've never done before. So then the stuff goes over to, that's it. Do you want to explain how some of the automatic firing?
Two slides from now.
Two slides, okay. So I'm going to go here, and then I'll skip back.
Okay, so here on the left you can see, the right goes first, that's the plane with the rocket launch, and, you know, we really trusted this thing by the end, enough to put an expensive HD camera in it and let it fly out to sea where we really couldn't even see it anymore, and it went around and did its thing and came back. On the left is a high-speed shot of the cannon firing, so the cannon algorithm basically took the latitude and longitude from Joe's stuff, mapped it to the Earth ellipsoid, converted it to direction and range, and the first time we fired this thing, I trued up the cannon with a magnetic compass and went to do a test shot, and it was way off beam, like by about 17 degrees. What the hell is going on? You know, and I was like, well, you know, maybe it's some like magnetic north true north thing, but it can't be 17 degrees. So I'm, you know, tweaking a few other things, and finally I go and look it up, and well, what's the difference between those two norths in San Francisco? It's bloody well 17 degrees. Initially we had two servos on the cannon, the bearing and the azimuth, to try and get the shot, and we were failing miserably at that in a whole bunch of test shots, so we locked down the cannon elevation and started controlling the chamber pressure with a computer-controlled valve on the cannon pressure system, and that got really nice linear range. You could basically map out the range to the pressure. It worked really nicely. And then the anemometer data was used to correct for the wind speed and direction.
So that was the cannon. And thanks. And then so for the UAV, for the airplane, which was essentially a completely separate project other than the wristband transmitter that we also had to do. So we used this model hobby airplane. I don't remember the part number. And we had this MicroPilot MP2028, which was this awesome UAV control system that hooked up to the airplane, and we used some control software that they provided. So a lot of the autonomy of the flight and the sensors and all the airplane was done. We just had to figure out how to get the airplane to the right place and drop the package, which sounds easy, but it really wasn't.
This is another example about when you're doing stuff on a really short timeline, and it's good advice for anyone that does prototyping is, you know, look what you can get off the shelf and how you can hack it to do what you want it to do. And so I had been to the Maker Faire, and I saw, like, this guy that does DIY drones. Earlier, before we even knew we were doing this project, I was like, oh, shit, I didn't know you could get these off-the-shelf UAV control things. And so then I knew when we got this project coming up that there was stuff available out there. And we talked to these guys from MicroPilot. They're from Canada A, and they were super helpful. We had them on the phone all the time, the guy who runs the company, saying, you know, hey, dude, like, we're having this problem and that problem, and they helped us out massively with their piece of equipment. It also came with a simulator, so we could do a lot of stuff in the lab without having to go out and crash more planes. I think we crashed the plane, and it had to be completely rebuilt about five times.
Yeah.
Steve Leshevsky was up all night for about a week straight building a new plane every time we crashed it. And the launch procedure for the UAV then became taking this off-the-shelf thing, getting the coordinates from Joe's transmitter. You had to set up an approach path for the plane because you can plug in a waypoint, but the planes had various PID loops that would control how it tried to approach a waypoint, because it's not made for doing bombing runs. It's just made from going from place to place and coming back, hopefully, in one piece. So we had to actually set up a couple of different waypoints so it would get on a line for doing this bombing run. Then we ran into the problem that the GPS on this system only updates at 1 hertz, and the plane travels at about 70 feet per second. So that's not a really good range of error when you've got a guy in the water that's probably drowning. So that took a lot of
really
tweaking. Joe was our test guy. He was about a mile out to sea from the launch part of the plane, and he got terribly seasick He was out there all day, and the only thing there was to eat on the boat was jalapeno bagels.
Oh, it was the worst. Oh, and what made it worse is we were at Stinson Beach, which is like the center point of the Red Triangle in the Bay Area, which is like where 50% of all great white shark attacks happen. And you know, the producers were like, they didn't give a shit, but then afterwards one of the producers was like, I was just waiting for you to get sucked under the water. I'm like, thanks.
I'm there on the base station and like talking to Joe on the radio. How you doing? He's like, terrible. I'm terrified of the sharks. I'm really sick and all we've got is jalapeno bagels. And I thought he was joking about those bagels. I mean, who ever even heard of a jalapeno bagel?
Yeah, it was crazy, but both systems ended up working really well, and we were happy to have that project done. So I do want to mention all of the details. All of my engineering work and some of Zaza's stuff is on my website. As far as the notes of my schematics and my firmware and circuit board designs and all that stuff. So you know, if you guys are interested in building upon it or learning about it, go to my site, grab whatever. And you know, let me know if you do something cool with it. So how much time do we have? One. We have 1 minute? 1 minute. Okay, so I guess we
questions.
Will, yeah. Well, okay. So we're gonna be dragged off to what room?
You are right across the hall.
We're right across the hall, 106, the breakout room. So I guess we have 1 minute, so one question.
How about one quick question?
Well, let me just say one quick thing about the fact that all this stuff's online, and I'm a slacker and I didn't put any of my stuff online yet. Which I'm probably not going to put the code online because it's not really useful to anyone. Most of what I wrote was in my custom Java environment that no one else has. I stole it from Media Lab. But I am going to put the schematics up for the one board I had fabbed, which was the robotic dog sitter. But the reason that stuff is online and what we really hope people get out of it is the idea that this isn't something that you need a PhD to do, that only some kind of super elite person can do. Everyone can do this kind of stuff if they put in the effort and want to do it.
Yeah.
And I really hope people are going to take advantage of this stuff and look at it and use it for their own projects.
Yeah. And we're engineers first and just happen to get sucked into TV. So there you go. Thank you.